And I bore my other, this is my inheritance from my stepfather, George Beverly Shedd, was two very nice Hawaiian shirts. And this is the second one of the two. So I wanted to share them both with you. So this is a, we've been going through Matthew 17, 22-18, 34, which is Jesus teaching the two disciples when they gathered for the last time in Capernaum after the transfiguration, but before he left for Jerusalem and the crucifixion, death, and resurrection. And this is a discourse of seven stories that we were covering over four Sundays. And the first five stories were the miracle of the coin in the fish's mouth, and the millstone around the neck for causing little ones to stumble, the gouge out your eye and cut off your hand if they cause you to sin, the 90 and 9 sheep story, and what you're supposed to do before you kick people out of your church. So today is the last day of the series. We're going to cover the last two stories. And that's forgiving 70 times 7 and what happens to unforgiving people. And this is answering the question of what are the limits of justice and mercy. So in these seven stories are Christ's response to his disciples' question, who is the greatest in your kingdom? And of course he does what I always told my clients to do, is if you don't like the question somebody asks you, you think of one that you really would like to answer, and you answer that one. So that's what he did. So the disciples were Second Temple Jews. Forgive me, I know this is repeating for some of you, but the Second Temple Jews expected a political Messiah. The Second Temple is basically everything that happened after the First Temple of Solomon was destroyed by the Babylonians. And the Jews had waited 400 years since the destruction of Solomon's temple. They had a temple. Actually, it was the third temple. It was beautiful. It was covered with gold. They had all of the sacrifices. Everything was going just fine. Except the bad guys were still in charge, the Romans. Now, Christ has already told his disciples who he really is, or they confessed it, and then he confirmed it. He's Messiah. But his disciples expected that this would be to their personal advantage, that they would be elevated into high office as once they all got to Jerusalem, which they were about to do. So that's what they meant by asking, who is the greatest in your kingdom? And Christ tells them, and he's telling them, redemption's coming. My kingdom's coming. In fact, it's here. And all the things you ever wondered about are going to be put right, just like you read about. But Christ says, first, I have to die. That is not what they wanted to hear. That is creating problems among them, as it sinks in that Christ is not meeting their expectations. But Christ told them, unless you turn, you will never enter the kingdom. Perhaps, meaning, it could be right under your nose, and you would still not see it. So last week, we went through verses 17 to 21 of Matthew 18, which I told you looked to me, look like steps toward a legal case against the debtor. Of course, I have a hammer and everything looks to me like a nail, so that's logical. But according to Jewish law, people who lacked the means to pay their debts could ultimately be sold as personal slaves. And Christ says, the most humble among you is the greatest. He who would be greatest among you must become your slave, your debt slave. Christ will be the one who substitutes himself for people who can't possibly pay their debts and must be sold as slaves. So, I think it's one of the the great sage Bob Dylan, everybody's got to serve somebody. It seems like somebody's slave. Anyway. So back to Matthew 17, Matthew 18, verse 17. We went last week through a couple of the steps that looked to me like it was going to the legal case. One says, if you go to your debtor or whoever has sinned against you, and you confront him, and then if that doesn't work, you bring two of your friends, and now you've got a witness to the fact that you warned him. And then he says, if that doesn't work, you tell them the church. And if the church, which is a gathering of those worship, and then he says, let them meet to you as a, if that doesn't work, then he says, let them meet you as a Gentile and a tax collector. For most of us, we understand, and it's interesting how many people came up to me and said, well, the book of Mormon says, but that's when you get to kick people out of your church. And it's good for them. It's good for them. But the catch here is that Jesus is telling them that he meets you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So who's telling the story? Matthew, the tax collector. So this is probably funny. I think it's funny and it's hilarious. What's really funny about it is, how does Christ teach Greek tax collectors? Well, you look in his own account of what happened to him in the book of Matthew. He threw a big party. Christ threw a big party and invited him and all of his funny friends. And they were paying. Now, something like this happened to Fran and I. We've been to Rome a couple times for PRMI, making some connections in the Vatican with some bishops there. But we noticed that every time we go, they want to go out to eat. They want to party. And they expect us to pay for it. And they pick a really nice place. And I realized, this is how you treat Gentiles and tax collectors. You invite them out to eat, they pay, and you have a really nice time. So, and then we talk about verses 19 and 20, binding and loosing, or forbidding and permitting. And that binding and releasing people and things was something the Pharisees did. And to anybody who's worked with debt or debtors, that should be very familiar. Security is bound, and then when a debt is paid, it's released. So that this is all right up that same alley. And also the disciples would have been thinking, hey, because this is what the Pharisees did. This was part of their job, was binding and loosing. And this Pharisee said, hey, we get to bind and loose. That's just going to be great. And then we talked about, finally, verse 21, was where two or three are gathered, which is generally taught, well, this is Christ floating over the couch when they're praying. And I don't think that's what it meant. I could be wrong. But I think he's talking about the meeting of three, which was when somebody takes on the debt of another person and fully extinguishes it, not just assumes it, which according to our law, if you assume somebody's debt, they owe and you owe, but that's not what the meeting of three was. When three got together, then that was witnesses to the fact that the original debtor was completely released, didn't owe the money, and a new person had taken their place as substitute debtor, which is not something that we really have in our laws. I mean, you could do it, but you have to be very intentional about it. But they'd call it the meeting of three. So, but this is what, I think it's what he meant when he talked about becoming the slave of another. Because that was the legal consequence of owing money with no means to pay. So now I think Peter is thinking through all this. And he's beginning to connect the dots. And it's disturbing him. In verse 21, Peter says, then Peter came up to him and said to him, and my question is, and I don't know the answer, but was this privately? Was there a reason why the others didn't hear this? And he didn't want to, and maybe this is something he and Matthew talked about later, or, you know, what happened there? I don't know. Perhaps he just didn't want to hear his question. So Peter says, Peter came up and said to him, verse 21, chapter 18, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times? And Jesus said to him, I do not say to you seven times, but 77 times. I think sometimes you get that 70 times seven, but that's basically what he said. So Peter says, how often will my brother sin against me, and how many times do I forgive? Yeah, I could be wrong. I don't think the fisherman was thinking abstractly about sin and wrongdoing. I think he was thinking about, how is this going to affect him? And maybe, how is this going to affect his wallet? Because I think he was asking Christ, if I have to treat people who don't pay me back, the same way you treat Matthew the tax collector, then how he didn't tolerate it. Then how many times? I mean, how many times do I have to let someone borrow something from me or do something to me and stiff me? How many times? And this is progress. Now he's asking Jesus, what are the limits of mercy and forgiveness? Which is what these two stories is all about. And it's the penultimate story before he heads off to the crucifixion and resurrection. So I think this is the capstone of everything he's teaching them right here. And his progress, as far as Peter's concerned, is Christ finally got him off of the question of whether he's going to get to be prime minister for a little while. He gets back to that, but that's another story. So remembering that these are Second Temple Jews, they knew their Old Testament backward and forward. You didn't have to explain things to them like you do to us, and like I'm doing right now. It's like if I say to you, Delaware, what do you think of? Washington Crossing B. You know, I don't even have to finish the sentence, right? You know, and you get the picture, and he's in the boat, and that requires an explanation of context. So this is what happens, this is what Christ is doing. He and Peter now are riffing back and forth on stories that we get that need an explanation, but they didn't. So here's what I think Peter and Christ were referring to from the Old Testament. This is in Genesis 4. Adam made love to his wife Eve. She became pregnant, gave birth to Cain. With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Abel kept flocks. Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, we don't know how much time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. He does first. And his brother finds out about this. Cain also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. He's angry at God. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what's right, will you not be accepted? That's the point of it. But if you do not what is right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. Now, Cain said to his brother, let's go out to the field. While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. So God accepted Abel's sacrifice, not Cain's. God did not live up to Cain's expectations. And that is sin crouching at the door. It's not about getting your sacrifice wrong. It's about getting your expectations wrong with God and getting angry with him. That's sin crouching at the door. It's not God likes sheep better than vegetables. Okay? So then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" If he didn't know, "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." That is justice. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. I cannot bear the weight of justice. Today, you are driving me from the land." That's all he knew to do. He was a farmer. He's driven from the land. "And I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on earth. Whoever finds me will kill me." Cain is suddenly realizing that he can't go out in the field and tend his vegetables. Regardless of the curse, people who know what he did to his brother are going to go out and do the same thing to him. So Cain is banished for his crime as justice, meaning he has to outrun it, because there's no one left who cares enough about whether he lives or dies or to defend him, because he killed the only person who could be his redeemer kinsman. Now the redeemer kinsman, in a world without police, is the only person between you and someone who would do you harm. Because the redeemer kinsman is that everyone knows that if I mess with you, my brother's coming after me. Now what happened when you just killed your redeemer kinsman? Got a problem. And that's what he said. Every man's hand will be against me. No reason not to. So, God says to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance 7 times over. Put mark, 7 times over. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Okay, so God offers something very special to Cain, to give people who might think there are no consequences of killing Cain something, a reason not to do that. Even though he did that to his brother, God is saying, "I will make consequences for you." So our humble God volunteers to take the place of Abel as angry, restless Cain's redeemer kinsman, and that is a type of Christ. That's mercy. Judgment. You're out of here. Mercy. No, you're not getting away from me. I will redeem 7 times. Okay. Nonetheless, Cain becomes a restless wanderer on the earth. Disappointment with God leads to anger and restlessness. But where did your restlessness take you? What's in your wallet? So continuing the story of Cain, because we got to get to 70 times 7 before we quit here. Cain made love to his wife. She became pregnant, gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. Enoch was born Ira, and Ira was the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael was the father of Mahuzwarel, and Lamech was the father of Lamech. Lamech said to his wives, "I killed a young man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, Lamech 77 times." There it is. The rabbis taught that the wives of Lamech were anxious, that there was a limit to what God was willing to do to protect the line of Cain. And Lamech was trying to convince him, "No, you're safe. It's okay. I've got this." Lamech says, basically, "If God protects Cain as substitute redeemer kinsman by sevenfold vengeance, I will be protected 77 times. So, I believe Peter, referring seven times in the context of forgiveness, is going back to Cain who killed his brother. Peter brings up Cain, gets seven chances to get it right, seven free bites. That's how the right of the balance is interpreted. So what are the limits of justice and mercy? So this is kind of like treading water and holding two basketballs at the same time. You know, justice, one's justice, one's mercy, and you get one worked out, the other one pops up. So Peter says, Christ is saying to Peter, I see your Cain, and I raise you a Lamech. And then Christ takes Peter, the Jew, completely over the edge. Matthew 18, 23. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven, this is the place they wanted to know who was going to be the greatest, may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him owing 10,000 talents. Since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and his children and all that he had, and payment to be made. Debt slave. Okay. What about this king? Wait, why didn't he want to settle accounts? Is he going to take a trip? Thought he might get back? That was one reason. Is he going to die? That was one reason. Christ is getting ready to go to Jerusalem. It was time to settle accounts, right? So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, have patience with me, and I will pay you everything. 10,000 talents. Out of pity for him, the master of the servant released him and forgave the debt. We get a lot of stuff with 10,000 talents, like 70 times 7, it's infinity, and 10,000 more. No, it's more, far more focused than that. So who is the guy who owes 10,000 talents in the Old Testament? The disciples, just like Washington, Delaware, would have immediately thought of wicked Haman in the story of Esther. That's the only place where 10,000 talents comes up in the Old Testament. Disciples would have immediately thought of it because it's told as a children's story. It's in little kid Hebrew. If you go take Hebrew in seminary or college or whatever, you get the book of Esther because it's easy to translate. The verb declensions are easy. The vocabulary is easy. It's a little kid story. It's a heck of a story to read to little kids, but they would have heard it. Wicked Haman and the 10,000 talents. So Haman was an Amalekite, and those were people who always went for the stragglers and the sick and followed the Jews as they traveled, and God hated them. And he told Saul, he will kill every last one of them. He did not. Saul disobeyed. That allowed their line to continue. They continued to torment the Jews all the way to Babylon. So this guy Haman is a greatly trusted advisor. He's called the barber to the Persian king. And in a place where uneasy hangs ahead of every monarch, who do you trust more than anyone? Your barber. He's the only person who can take a razor to your neck. So to go against Haman, like Mordecai did, and Esther did, was a non-starter. And I won't repeat the story to you. It's a lot of fun, especially the Jewish Encyclopedia. So Haman offered the king 10,000 talents of silver for permission to do with the Jews as he pleased. And he wanted to kill them, persecute them, to finally get rid of them. And Haman's own answer to the king's question, what should be done to him to whom the king delights to honor, which Haman soon referred to himself, obliged Haman to leave Mordecai, his mortal enemy, clad in royal garments, seated on the king's horse through the king's streets of the capital to proclaim, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And the rabbis add that one of the things that Haman had to do was get down on his hands and knees to make it easier for Mordecai to get on the king's horse. So afterward, Haman was again drinking with the king in a banquet prepared by Esther. There's another one of those parties. The latter is exposed to King Haman's plot. To the king, Haman, Esther tells the king about Haman's plot. The guy with the, you really can't trust the guy with the razor after all. King's filled with anger, orders his officers to hang Haman on the very gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai. So where does Haman in this story get 10,000 talents of silver? It was an extraordinary sum, enough to buy off a king and a kingdom. So let's just assume, for purposes of Christ incorporating Haman into his explanation of the kingdom of heaven, is Haman borrowed it. So wicked Haman, the Amalekite, is who Christ uses to give the example of an utterly undeserving scoundrel who gets forgiven of an extravagant debt. When that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. Seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, "Pay what you owe." So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me and I will pay you." He refused and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. So what about the guy who owed 100 denarii? Well, that's a Roman silver coin. It's basically a dime. So he owed 10 bucks. And this was a coin that payment was made by the Jews as a civil tribute to the Roman emperors, not the temple tax that we talked about. It was a special coin for that, but it's just their general taxes. And this coin had the titles and the effigies of the reigning monarch. This is where Jesus gets rendered to Caesar, the things that are Caesar's, holds the coin. Who's on the coin? Caesar. And he says, "Render to God the things on God, whose image is on us, God." That's that story. So when his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed, and went to report to their master all that had taken place. His master summoned them and said to him, "You wicked servant, Haman, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and should not have had mercy on you. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant, as I had mercy on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also, my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. And again, we're back to the story last week before last, about the story where your own right eye and right hand lead you astray. That's a heart issue. But what are the limits of justice and mercy in this case? They seem to be opposed to each other, can't reconcile. So wrap this up, let's go back to Matthew 18, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Calling down a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Micah 6:8, "It showed you, O Lord, but O Lord, O man, what is good? What does the Lord require of you? Do just, act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Tread water and hold free basketball for your life." So these stories having to do with being in debt and no hope of ever paying it back is where justice and mercy and humility all come together. Are you disappointed by people not meeting your expectations? Are you disappointed by not meeting your own expectations? Is it the Messiah who disappointed you in some way that didn't accept your sacrifice? Somebody else's, but not yours. Is that making you restless? Are you inclined to wander? Find wander, Lord, I feel it. Find prone to leave the God I love. Somewhere you'd rather be than where you ended up. What does it mean then to walk humbly with your God? Christ is headed to Jerusalem to pay debts he did not. That's the meaning of three. The three or more gathered in my name. There I am in the midst of them. I'm the guy who takes on the debt. That's what being in the midst of them means. So debts of sin are owed to God. My debt, your debt, soon to be extinguished by Christ, becoming a debt slave in our place and taking our debt on the cross. So finally, we're answering the question, what are the limits of justice and mercy? See, our debt gets paid. That's justice. And it would be unjust for us to revisit that and go back to it and say, oh, that's not enough. This sacrifice isn't good enough. We've got to do that. No, no. Justice has been served. The debt has been paid. And to say otherwise is to mock the cross. But being a debt slave in our place is mercy. That's mercy. Those are the limits of justice and mercy, which is humility is the limit of justice and mercy. God is the greatest in the kingdom. Christ is the greatest in the kingdom because he's the most humble. This is God who speaks to people in words. He makes contracts with people who cannot possibly hold up their end of the bargain. And he does it for them. That's the limit of justice and mercy. Humility. And that is an example that Christ is giving his disciples to ponder as he went to the cross to finish it up. That's it. Thanks. As I say, no more.